Au hea oko e ko ka aha. Inahe kuleana i mua o kea aha. Ho o kolokolo ki e ki e hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nao e mai, e malio mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC16167. Carvalho v. AIG Hawaii Insurance Company, Inc., et al. Arguing for the petitioner, Arthur Y. Park. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen L. Godel. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon and aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, if a justice has a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. We'll begin today by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they will be arguing.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. It's Arthur Park representing the plaintiff appellant petitioner. Carvalho. Burnett Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Goto.
Good afternoon, Steve Goto representing respondents at Belly.
All right, thank you, Mr. Goto. Just to confirm, each side has 30 minutes for argument. Mr. Park, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning 20 minutes in with the tone and a light, 20 minutes into your argument to let you know that you've reached that 20 minute mark. Mr. Goto, we will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go, and then again at the end of your allotted 30 minutes. So both of you will hear a light or see a light and hear a tone at the end of your 30 minutes. Mr. Park, please proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, may it please the court, including the other justices of the court. The ICA, or the Intermediate Appellate Court in this case, set up some very dangerous precedent in terms of ruling on two motions with respect to defendant's motion to limit evidence in this case. I see granted, or the trial court granted the motion to preclude evidence and argument, and this was affirmed by the ICA. The problem with that ruling is that the ICA determined that this was a motion in limine, and what that motion to preclude did was pretty much exclude part of our claim for bad faith, which is not appropriate for a motion in limine. It should have been a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. So this is obviously is setting a bad precedent for the future, so that a motion in limine will be used to strike claims, or at least in our case with part of claims, and I can see where it might be used to strike total claims without following the rigorous requirements of Rule 56 for summary judgment. So the other problem with this ruling is that it also avoids notice pleading, because in our complaint, we clearly stated in count five, covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is basically claiming bad faith as one of our allegations. Defendant AIG set up a straw man by arguing to the trial court that we were arguing essentially the failure to pay policy limits, and then they turned around and said that there is no bad faith because they paid the policy limits. And but with the bad faith allegation in our complaint, I mean, that is a much broader allegation than just one narrow argument. And in fact, what we were arguing specifically, but including but not limited to, was a delay in payment, which there was clearly an unnecessary delay. So that is dangerous precedents set with that ruling. The second dangerous precedent was with respect to denying our motion to amend, which, by the way, was brought only because of this motion to preclude, which was filed with the court earlier. We filed a motion to amend the complaint by adding more facts relating to the bad faith. And there was no further claim in that motion for to amend. And we probably would not have filed that motion to amend if this motion to preclude hadn't been filed. So the question of whether we were filing late or close to the trial, I mean, that was, we felt we had to counter this motion to preclude, which the trial court, of course, granted. And then, so the problem with the second ruling regarding denying our motion to amend is that the trial court made no finding of bad faith, which is required under the prevailing law, and then the ICA affirmed that. So, so in the future, this case is going to be cited, if it's allowed to stand, for denying a motion to amend strictly on undue delay.
Mr. Park, what about the issue of prejudice? Was that raised by the defendant here? And do you think the record supported it? And would that, if there is a showing of prejudice, how should the court assess that in deciding whether to grant such a motion?
Well, the arguments for prejudice, we believe were really not thoroughly vetted by the trial court. So I think one thing, since the trial court and the IC did not really talk about prejudice to the defense, I would argue that the court should disregard those arguments. But what did they argue? For example, selling the company. Did that cause prejudice? We don't know. Trial court never did any finding, and the IC, as far as I know, is not supposed to be making any findings of fact. What is the second one? That people left. The case, the bad faith facts in this case are contained in the claim diary, which we cited in our motion to amend. It's rife with bad faith, okay? So this case basically is gonna stand or fall on what's in that claim diary, okay? And these are, contains emails and notes of discussions about how they knew that the limits we're asking were correct under their own internal max stack policy, but yet they kept telling us, no, it's this lower 3570 coverage instead of the 300 totaling 1.2 coverage. And it wasn't until we filed our complaint, our bad faith complaint, that they conceded that the coverage was 1.2. And then they we made a demand and they refused. So we then were forced to go to arbitration, which arbitrator found $3 million in damages. AIG, as far as we're concerned, there's all kinds of bad faith in this case, offered to settle this for $300+, which was strictly, you know, based on an opinion from their economist, Eiderhaug, for lost income. no mention of general damages. At the arbitration, the arbitrator found 500 in general, for lost income, and 2.5 for general damages, loss of enjoyment of life, mental distress, etc. So they clearly should have tendered, instead of making us go and have the parents relive this incident again.
Mr. Park, we have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Park, I wanted to get your help in sort of understanding the record with respect to the denial of your motion to amend. First, I wanted to get your sense of why the motion to amend was denied. And if I understand correctly, one of the concerns of the trial court seemed to be that there was an approaching trial, that the discovery deadline was approaching. And in that regard, the court was concerned that there was going to have to be extra discovery on a bad faith claim. But you're indicating that from your point of view, the complaint adequately informed AIG that there was a bad faith claim coming. So could you help me with that? What did the court, the circuit court, rightfully determine that the bad faith claim had not yet been added to the complaint and that there would be additional discovery required?
Your Honor, Mr. Justice, I don't believe any further discovery would have been required. AIG is trying to make a big deal out of the passage of time, and they had time to prepare for this case. At the same time, they're throwing back at us. So for them to come up, there was nothing. We did not make any new claim in the motion to amend. We were just adding facts basically out of their own claim file, which they knew. And I suspect if and when we get the rest of the claim file, there'll be even more bad faith that we can claim. We only got the claim file up to the time we filed the complaint. But they had sent that to us voluntarily. When we made a discovery demand, they flatly refused for citing privacy and all kinds of things. So I don't think that there was any real basis to deny our motion to amend. And as I said, we only filed it because they had filed this motion to preclude. And we felt that maybe the court needed more information. And so.
And could you then help me with, how do you interpret the reason that the circuit court denied your motion to amend?
Well, quite frankly, Your Honor, this was a new judge up at the circuit court, and I don't know how much he really knew of civil procedure and so forth, the case law having to do with motion to amend and how there has to be a finding of prejudice and so forth.
Mr. Park, Justice Nakayama has a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Park, in your initial complaint, among other causes of action, including negligence and emotional distress and punitive damages, you make specific claims regarding breach of contract and unfair and deceptive practices and breaches of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which generally speaking, I assume you're meaning a bad faith, but a bad faith claim. What do you say about Mr. Goto's claim that factually you're just alleging that they didn't stack the policies? That was what you're alleging, that as you mentioned before, they were willing to stack some of them, but not all of them. But your concern was they're reluctant to stack the policies. Did you allege other things in your complaint?
Your Honor, we did not allege all the facts that would go to bad faith, because we for example, we didn't really cite facts out of the claim file, which we did, if I recall correctly, cite in the, our motion to amend. And so there would have been, you know, there are other theories of bad faith here, a failure to to explain non-payment on a reasonable basis. We have failure to tender, failure to investigate, that could have been investigated earlier, forcing us to arbitration without a reasonable basis. I'm probably missing some.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. I mean, everybody's kind of, well, you're kind of dancing around this, but you know, the award was April 2nd, 2009, and AIG paid it April 29th, 2009. And then the case lay fallow for 5.5 years until the circuit court initiated action on it. And even after you received the notice of status hearing from the court, it wasn't till 7 months later that you initiated work on this case or generated a status hearing or a trial setting conference. Why isn't this undue delay?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, the issue here is not the delay, but the fact that there was no showing of a prejudice to, and I'm talking about actual prejudice. I mean, AIG can make all kinds of arguments, but does it constitute prejudice? And there was no finding of prejudice or actual prejudice.
So you're conceding undue delay?
Well, I'm conceding that the time did pass. But let me point out another thing. Neither side made any issue of the delay until we started arguing these motions. And there was a stay in place, and you can argue that there's a potentially a difference in terms of whether the stay was should have been lifted formally or not. But it really, the stay became moot when the court noticed the status conference. And we, you know, then hopped to. And by the way, the time from the ARB decision to the notice of status conference by the court was, I believe, 4 years.
Mr. Park, we have a question from Justice Edens and then one from Justice McKenna. Justice Edens.
Mr. Park, you know, Fed courts considering motions to amend under the federal rule 15 have stated or observed that, you know, if the delay goes on and on, it's almost presumptively prejudicial. And I'll cite the First Circuit. There's a case called ACA Financial versus Advest, which is a 2008 case. And what they said was this: is the longer a plaintiff delays, the more likely a motion to amend will be denied as protracted delay with its attendant burdens on the opponent in the court. And that is itself a sufficient reason for the court to withhold permission to amend. So in this particular case, we have, you know, the decade ending, we are getting into the middle of the next decade, and then shortly before trial, you spring an amendment on AIG in the court. So I'm just wondering, at some point, can extreme delay become inherently prejudicial?
Mr. Park, you're muted. You need to unmute.
Excuse me?
You need to unmute, Mr. Park, sorry. So we didn't hear your answer so far.
As I said before, Mr. Justice, we probably would not have filed the motion to amend, and we did so in response to the motion to preclude. And that was erroneously granted by the trial court, and, you know, using a motion in limine, which is improper. So I don't know if our filing a motion to amend is really issue or an issue. We weren't planning to file it until this motion to preclude was filed.
Justice McKenna and then Justice Wilson.
Mr. Park, I understand that the stay was granted in 2008 pending the AIG DEC action, and then you reached a stipulated judgment to submit its DEC action to arbitration. And then in 2009, there was an ARB award, and then AIG transmitted policy limits. And then I guess there was 4 years until the notice of status hearing, but was there nothing happening between 2009 and 2013? Were there no settlement discussions going on?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So the case was really dormant for those 4 years?
Yes.
I see. So, all right. Okay.
Again,
in terms of the motion to preclude, what standard did the circuit court apply?
Well, we think he abuses discretion by granting.
Right. Did the circuit court apply a summary judgment standard to the motion to preclude?
I don't believe so, because it wasn't presented in that way or format. You know, there was no attempt at, to meet the requirements of summary judgment. And I happen to know that because we're in the middle of one right now where we're having to have affidavits or for the transcripts from the court reporters and all that. There's none of that in
Okay, thank you.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Park, I understand from your analysis that it's your position that the complaint contained a bad faith claim and that you were motivated to flesh that out, I think, by this additional motion you filed after you got the result on the motion to preclude. But what is left now if the motion to amend cannot be implemented? In other words, right now, your motion to amend's been denied, and there's something left in the case. As Justice McKenna said, there seems to have been a resolution of claims as a result of the arbitration award and a payment to a certain extent. But what would you say is left to be tried if, in fact, this court does not find error with the determination of the circuit court that the motion to amend shouldn't have been granted? Does it mean that there is no longer any claim for bad faith?
In our motion to amend, we cited numerous instances in the claim file, the AIG claim file, that we believe, for example, reflects bad faith. There's discussions about, the plaintiff is asking for $1.2 million. The base coverage was $3,570. But we have this max stack policy, internal policy in the company, that if somebody raises their limits to the max, unless they have excluded UMUIM, the UMUIM coverage should go up with the maximum coverage. So
would those allegations, in your view, be available to you now if the case proceeded to trial, or do you think you've been precluded from making those allegations?
Those are available to us now, and that's what is, I believe, one of the reasons the ICA remanded the case back, or overturned the summary judgment by the trial court and handing us for trial. But again, that's only one basis. And you can see in the discussion, the chief of justice is saying, tell him it's only 3570 and keep, and that they did that repeatedly, even though internally there's one person clearly said it should be 1.2 million. And they kept leading us on, and that caused us to eventually file suit. So to confirm the policy limits, that's what we were trying to confirm to begin with. And once they stated the limit, they agreed with us, we made a demand for the 1.2. If they had given us the 1.2, this is an experienced company, AIG. I don't know if there's any company more experienced. They knew that the claim was worth far more than 1.2, yet they pushed us to the ARB, to ARB the issue unnecessarily. We made a demand for the 1.2, they refused. And if they had, then it would probably would have been over. But they pushed us into this arbitration. So, and I don't think they had a reasonable basis. And that's one thing we can leave up to the jury. Do you think it was reasonable, this company, to push us to arbitration, especially since the decision came out almost three times what the policy limit was?
Mr. Park, we have a question from Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Park, when you filed your initial complaint in 2007, well, at the very end, as I mentioned, you asserted several claims of action, and it does appear that one of the claims of action is bad faith. When you went to arbitration, was there anything about the arbitration that limited the causes of action that were tried? So in other words, although the AIG disputed staffing, disputed damages, disputed coverage, when it went to arbitration, why wasn't the complaint resolved at that point in time with the 1.2 million? Was there anything specifically that said we're not resolving the bad faith?
The arbitration, as I recall, Ms. Justice, was for damages. That's what the arbitration was about.
Okay.
So, we presented a damages case. We presented, I believe we had an economist, and we presented the parents. So we were, talking about specials and generals, but there was no mention about, the arbitrator never knew about the 1.2 coverage, who was Judge Crabtree, by the way. Well, not yet Judge Crabtree.
Mr. Park, we're about 26 minutes in. Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time for rebuttal at this point?
Yes.
Okay. Very well. We'll move on to Mr. Goto then. Thank you, Mr. Park. Mr. Goto, your argument.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Justice Nakayama, Justice McKenna, Justice Wilson, and Justice Edens. May it please the court. I'd like to open by thanking you and thanking the court for the opportunity to address the court and to answer any questions you may have. While this case is deceivingly factually complex, the issues before the court this afternoon, I believe, is rather straightforward. Did the ICA grievously err in affirming the trial court's exercise of its discretion in one, granting the motion to preclude evidence related to an unpled claim, and two, denying the motion to amend the complaint, which was unquestionably delayed? The plain answer is no, and the proper result is to affirm the ICA's affirmance, the trial court's rulings. There is ample evidence in the record to support the trial court's proper exercise of its discretion. Going to the first issue identified by the plaintiffs, whether the ICA grievously erred in affirming the use of an in limine motion to dispose of a substantive basis of recovery. The answer is no. There was no substantive claim for failure to settle or pay in the complaint. Even under a notice pleading standards, the thrust of the complaint was clearly an alleged failure to offer or recognize the 1.2 million in combined UM-UIM limits. Going through the complaint, it's a little tedious and bear with me. Count one stated a claim for declaratory judgment. Paragraph 51 of the complaint states, plaintiff requests that the court declare the AIG policy provided stacked UM/UIM, ...... $1.2 million. Count two stated a claim for negligence. Paragraph 54, defendants failed to offer the Carvalhos an opportunity to purchase or reject the stacked or increased UM/UIM. Count three, breach of contract. Paragraph 60, defendants failed to offer. Count four, chapter 480, paragraph 67, Axion emissions were unfair and deceptive. That's all it states. Paragraph five, excuse me, count five, bad faith. Paragraph 70, AIG's refusal to acknowledge that stacked coverages totaling 1.2 were available breached the covenant of good faith. Count six, emotional distress. Count seven, punitives. Nowhere is there language suggesting that defendant breached a duty to pay timely. Moreover,
Goto, we have a question from Justice McKenna. Justice McKenna.
Mr. Goto, the complaint was filed, I believe, in December of 2007. Is that correct?
Correct.
I'm wondering how this December 2007 complaint could have alleged that payment was not timely made, since payment wasn't actually made until 2009.
Thank you. I agree. At the time that the complaint was filed, there had not been a demand for the 1.2. There had not been arbitration. There had not been a demand for arbitration. And the issue of Royden's residence had not been determined. Now, recall that the issue of Royden's residence presented an issue of payment because where Royden resided when not living with his mother, whether it was with his father, Hezekiah Kalavi, or with his grandparents, would then affect the decision of whether the Carvalhos policy was implicated at all. If Royden was living with his father, Hezekiah, then his policy would be implicated. If he was living with the Carvalhos, their policy would be implicated. So the Park firm was representing both Hezekiah Kalavi and Bernay Carvalho, both on behalf of the estate, making competing and conflicting claims on behalf of the estate as to where Royden was living. So until that's resolved, we don't know which policy is implicated. Without knowing that, we don't know which policy is in effect and how much the limits are.
So I'm assuming that the fact that you entered into a stipulated judgment as to your deck action at some point, I believe in 2008, I'm a little bit unclear, was it because of discovery that you were able to actually ascertain where Royden lived?
The stipulated judgment was in July 2008, and that was part of the deck action. That came about through basically mediated discussions with the trial judge, who, recognizing the conflict and the predicament that everyone was in, with all the attendant consequences, basically struck an agreement that the parties agreed that Royden was living with the grandparents and that no one would take any action for false swearing as to where Royden was actually living.
Okay. And then my understanding is that your motion to preclude evidence, you indicated, was based on an initial assertion that there was no bad faith claim for delayed payment. Is that right? Where there was no bad faith? You're not asserting that there was no bad faith claim in this complaint, right?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So you're just saying that the basis on which bad faith was now being alleged should have been precluded because it wasn't in the initial complaint, according to your position.
I think that's right.
But you know, we do have some case law, Kuroda versus Kuroda, O'Grady versus State. Motions to preclude evidence or motions in limine are not substitutes for motions for summary judgment, correct?
Correct.
Isn't your motion to preclude evidence tantamount to motion for summary judgment, asserting that there's no genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not these matters were properly pled or could be deemed to have, be consented to be tried. I'm not quite sure because it appears that things were happening in the deck action and in this case after the December 2007 complaint. So aren't there genuine issues of material fact, at least as to whether or not you folks were trying this by consent in terms of, by the fact that you, after the complaint was filed, you agreed to a stipulated judgment as to the initial basis of the complaint, I guess, as to stacking and payment. So I'm a little bit confused as to why a motion to preclude evidence can be used in this way, because it appears to me that this is a motion for summary judgment, and it appears to me that the court did not apply summary judgment standards.
Thank you. Respectfully, I disagree. I'm not sure if I can unpack the statement entirely, but let me try. This was not a motion for summary judgment. The matter was hanging out for 6.5 years, 7.5 years. And my client was asking me, what's going on? You know, the issue of that's alleged in the complaint of failure to recognize the 1.2 limits was resolved within 2 months. And actually within 2 days, we had sent a letter saying we're going to acknowledge that the 1.2 limits apply. But two months later, we file our answer and acknowledge it. What's left of the complaint? Nothing. So the client was asking me, how do we move this case? We had anticipated that there might be this claim of failure to timely pay. But again, that wasn't yet triggered because the issue of the residence wasn't determined. We didn't know which policy applied. And then once that was assessed, we didn't know what the amount of the damages were, which had to be resolved by the arbitration.
In terms of delay, here's my question. The accident was in 2005. You've now indicated to me that there really was no discovery, formal discovery, on the issue of where he was living. And it's a little bit, that's what I got from you. So I'm wondering, what about this 4-year delay in payment of the 1.2 million? Isn't there at least a question as to whether even that was an unreasonable delay?
I don't believe so. And I disagree with the statement that no discovery was conducted. So in the deck action, actually before that, what set up the deck action was sworn statements by the grandparents, by Hezekiah, conflicting statements, both presented by the Park Law Firm, where Royden was residing. And there were recorded statements taken, again, conflicting statements. And that had to be resolved by the deck action. And that was resolved by the deck action.
Okay, so you took depos in the deck action.
The recorded statements under oath.
I see. Okay.
That was again resolved. And okay. So before that issue was resolved, you didn't know what policy applied. So there can't be a failure to pay the 1.2 because it could have been Hezekiah's $40,000 policy. Okay.
So now, that's what was happening. When was the UIM, UM claim initially made? Soon after the 2005 accident?
The UM claim was made. First by Robert Marks in November 2005 on behalf of Hezekiah Kalavi, and then subsequently by Mr. Park in October of 2006 on behalf of Brene Carvalho.
Okay, so what happened in those intervening years? Why wasn't the issue of residence addressed and resolved between 2005 and 6 and 2009?
Well, again, because there were conflicting statements and the way to resolve it was through the deck action.
I see. So you filed your deck action when?
The deck action was filed. So the complaint was filed in December 31, 2007. The deck action was filed March 3, 2008.
Okay. You could have filed the deck action much earlier then, right? When you received the conflicting information in 2005 and or 2006.
I guess at that point there were conflicting claims. I think the idea was to try and resolve it between the parties. You know, there were discussions made between both, hey, what's going on, your conflict, what's really going on. And then the Hezekiah's counsel was switching from Mr. Marks to Mr. Park. So there were things going on.
Okay.
We have questions from Justice Wilson and then Justice Nakayama. Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Goto, you have analyzed this from the point of view of the standard applied to a motion to amend as opposed to a motion for summary judgment. I understand that, but following that train of analysis, let's assume that the complaint did need to be amended. And so there was a real issue before the court as to whether it should have been amended. Was the correct standard applied? Because I know you've seen the discussion in the materials about the standard in the healthcare case and the Owens case from the Ninth Circuit saying that prejudice must, that undue delay isn't enough and prejudice must be considered. And from that point of view, could you speak to whether or not prejudice was considered? And if it was, what was the prejudice that was of concern to the circuit court?
Thank you. We submitted briefing on the prejudice. And again, the prejudice was that during the interim 6.5 years, AIG was taken over by Farmers Away. Employees were let go, others were brought in, some were transitioned, new computer systems were brought in, memories fade, institutional knowledge is lost. And we would hope that that was considered by the trial court in addressing the motion to amend. However, you know, Hawaii law, going back to Hirasa and Bishop, states that there are only considerations under 15A, Rule 15A, HRCP, in addressing the motion to amend or not. No specific element is required. So specifically quoting from Hirasa, it states, in the absence of any apparent or declared reason, such as undue delay, bad faith, or dilatory motive on the part of the move-on, repeated failure to cure deficiencies by the amendments previously allowed, undue prejudice to the opposing party by virtue of the allowance of the amendment, futility of amendment, etc., ... then leave should, as rules require, be freely given. So Hirasa does not require undue delay, bad faith, or dilatory motive. Those are just examples given by the court as things to be considered. The court states only that there must be an apparent or stated reason to deny the motion to amend. Delay is a recognized reason. Futility is a recognized reason. Prejudice is a recognized reason. You don't need all of them. You don't need any of them. You just need the trial court to state the basis for it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to be clear. Are you suggesting that we don't follow the Ninth Circuit, or are you saying that in this case, even under the Ninth Circuit standard, it was met? Because if that's true, I'm having difficulty seeing where the circuit court focused on prejudice.
I think my response would be the rules of procedure, being procedural in nature, are a matter of state court and not federal court and federal law. The state court cases clearly state that those considerations are only factors and not one is determinative over the other.
Justice Nakayama, your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Goto, I think the plaintiffs make much of the fact that in so far as your claims of prejudice, that you already, did you already name witnesses to testify regarding bad faith? Expert witnesses and other factual witnesses?
Thank you. Defendants did name witnesses in their responsive pretrial statement.
Well, don't you need something more other than memories fade, files can't be found, did you have specific instances, I mean, because you were able to name witnesses, where because of the passage of time, AIG suffered prejudice?
Yes. To clarify, the witnesses that we listed in our pretrial statement, responsive pretrial statement, went to the allegations framed in the complaint, which was the failure to recognize the 1.2 million. We did list an expert witness to identify, to testify as to an alleged delay in payment on the assumption that plaintiffs might articulate it and on the risk that the trial court might make us go to trial on that issue, even though it had not yet been pled. So I think it's unfair to burden the defense with loading up for an issue which was not articulated and which we did not agree to litigate by consent. As in the Crescencia case, you know, we affirmatively filed a motion to preclude based on an unpled claim. For there to be consent, there has to be evidence going into the trial, into the record at trial without objection. We filed 7 months before trial to make sure that did not happen. So we believe we amply protected our rights not to litigate the claim by consent.
Justice Edmonds, your question, then Justice McKenna.
Mr. Goto, when you were responding to Justice Wilson, you seemed to indicate that undue delay alone could suggest a denial. And, you know, if I read Foman versus Davis, the 1962 SCOTUS case that many of our cases directly and indirectly reference, standing alongside bad faith and unfair prejudice is undue delay alone. So let's say that undue delay alone would support your position. I look at the scheduling order in this particular case with various deadlines, and it seems to suggest to me that motions made by the plaintiffs in this case, the motion to amend, was made before the deadline in this case. So how would that be untimely?
The trial court found it to be untimely based on the length, I assume there weren't articulated specific findings, but based on the delay of the case, again, 7.5 years after the complaint, 6.5 years after we had already paid the 2.1 or the 1.2 million in limits, 1.5 years after the pretrial statement that plaintiff filed, which did not articulate a claim for delay of payments, and 60 days after we filed our motion to preclude, which was basically an invitation to file a motion to amend, and why they waited 60 days when the deadlines were clearly coming up, I don't know. I can't speak to that. So I think clearly the court was watching its own calendar. It raised the issue of, you know, why this case was lying on its docket for so long by itself. You know, the parties had, you know, in between these motions.
Mr. Bell, let me just interject here. And I see an interplay in certain circumstances with Rule 16. And Rule 16 is the scheduling order rules. And under federal law, if there is a motion made after the scheduling order deadline, a motion to amend, you first have to look at good cause and then decide on the merits of the motion. But in this particular case, I look at the scheduling order and they met their deadline, so we don't even reach that stage. Can you tell me a little bit about what your understanding is or what your take is on Rule 16's interplay with Rule 15?
I don't believe Rule 16 was discussed or raised to the trial court or an appeal. So first off, I believe any arguments related to that would be waived. Second, again, the trial court was, I think, fiercely protective of its calendar. It raised the issue of the dormancy of the case on its own. Between the motions to preclude and the motion to amend, after those were resolved, the parties, the plaintiff and defendant, filed a stipulation to continue the trial date to engage in negotiations. The trial court denied that motion. So clearly the court was concerned about the length the case had been on its docket. It wanted it resolved. So That combined with the delay caused by plaintiffs, I think was ample reason for the court to exercise its discretion in denying the motion to amend.
Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna.
Mr. Goto, you've indicated that, you know, you were being asked by your client as to why this case, how to move this case along. It appears there, you paid out the policy limits in 2009. And then the case was set for trial, but you filed a motion to preclude evidence. And then the motion to amend was denied. And then you filed a motion for summary judgment on the grounds that the claims that were in the complaint had already basically been resolved, correct?
Correct.
So basically what you were saying is that the complaint, there was nothing left in the complaint after 2009, right?
Correct.
So then why didn't you just file a motion to dismiss based on Rule 41B1 for failure of the plaintiff to prosecute? Isn't that really what you were trying to do, was to file a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute by saying there's nothing left in the complaint and this case has been pending, so it should just be dismissed?
Correct, ultimately. And I think there's three reasons in response to your question. First, you know, I'm not that smart. It took me a while to figure out, you know, what the proper mechanism to advance the case was. When I was looking at the case at the time, I thought there was a question of alleged damages that could be made that would create the question of fact as to the 2-month delay between the complaint was filed and the acknowledgement of the 1.2 was made. It wasn't until later that I recognized that until the issue of Royden's residency and the amount of damages were affixed in arbitration, that any delay could not have resulted in any damages. Okay. So secondly, we were on the horns of a dilemma. To file a motion to dismiss or for summary judgment or for a failure to advance the case would be an immediate invitation to plaintiff to amend the complaint. And so we risked doing that too early and basically, you know, opening ourselves up to an entirely new case, or doing it too late, in which case we'd be accused of sandbagging. So we chose the middle ground. We filed the motion 7 months before the trial to give, you know, plaintiffs an opportunity to file a motion to amend while still saying, you know, that they had to do it urgently. Why they waited 6 months, I don't know. Third, you know, as you're aware, under the failure to prosecute rules, there has to be prejudice. You know, during this 6.5-year period after that the arbitration award was paid, there was nothing happening. We weren't accruing costs. There weren't discovery costs. You know, there was nothing happening. So, you know, amassing evidence of prejudice associated with delay, compared with, you know, resolving someone's claim on the basis of, you know, whatever's left, you know, the imbalance, you know, wasn't perfect. So circling back, you know, when we filed the motion to preclude, you know, it was not the equivalent of a motion for summary judgment, you know, because I considered a motion for summary judgment on an unpled claim and it just doesn't exist. So it took a while to come up with a remedy of motion to preclude evidence related to the unpled claim. Because you can't dismiss something that's not pled. And so once the motion to preclude, as in Crescencio, was granted, that then queued up, well, what's left? And after disposing of the motion to amend, what's left was a claim for a 2-month delay, after which there could not be any damages because the residence and the amount were not yet fixed, and the court granted it. You know, the ICA reversed a portion of that, and going back to a previous question, and basically remanded a question of emotional distress during that interim period. You know, I think our response would be that, you know, unfortunately, Royden had passed in the accident, and he being the defined insured could not have incurred any emotional distress. The PR advancing the case, is not the proper party to advance the motion to distress to someone who didn't accrue it. So, you know, on remand, we'll take care of that issue, but there was nothing left.
All right. Like, so I'm sorry. Can I just follow up real quick?
I'm so sorry. You're done with Justice McKenna.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. So I still a little. Do you think you could have filed a Rule 41B1 motion for involuntary dismissal?
You know, frankly, I hadn't thought of it, but I don't know that it would have been granted. Again, the level of prejudice, I don't think would outtip a motion to dismiss based on the delay.
Actually, because under Rule 41B1, we do have a recent case construing that, Aaron versus Lego, and it's not just prejudice that you would have had to satisfy. You would have had to show that the dismissal of the case not only have to cause actual prejudice to your client, and only when there's a deliberate delay that causes actual prejudice to a defendant that cannot be addressed through lesser sanctions should a case be dismissed on this basis. It appears that you've decided to procedurally file a motion to preclude, which you say is not subject to summary judgment standards, but then eventually ended up filing a motion for summary judgment. Anyway, this is very confusing procedurally. Thank you.
It is.
Yeah, Mr. Goto, the showing of prejudice was simply, as I saw it, and perhaps correct me if I'm wrong, was a blog post about AIG being acquired by Farmers. There's nothing about employees being let go or documents being lost. I mean, is there anything in the record to specifically identify any of those things happening?
I don't believe so.
So would you concede, and in fact, the ICA didn't really go, you know, seem to suggest there was prejudice. Would you concede on this record there really is not a showing of prejudice other than just some the generalized assumptions that perhaps there could be prejudice given the amount of time?
I think I would concede that the trial court did not consider it or did not state that it factored into its conclusion. And that the trial court did base its decision on the undue delay, which under Harasa and Bishop and everything else and its progeny is sufficient. As long as there is a stated basis, it's fine.
Now we're gonna go back under the ICA's ruling for a trial, and your view that trial would be regarding the emotional distress damages associated with bad faith in not recognizing the 1.2 million. Is that your understanding of what the case is going back for?
That's my best attempt at parsing the ICA's statement on that point.
And wouldn't that involve essentially the same documents, same witnesses as the claim we're talking about here? In other words, the question, based on the record, is there anything to suggest that the witnesses or other evidence that would be needed to go to whether there should have been a payout of benefits as opposed to what the limit was would be any different?
I think the two claims would be dramatically different. The decision whether or not to acknowledge the 1.2 was basically a coverage decision. At the time, you know, 13 years ago, there wasn't clear law on what constituted whatever the buzzwords were, which would have triggered the duty to make the offer of stacking. There was a federal court case that said that, and let me backtrack. What had happened here was the Carvalhos had added a driver, had substituted cars, and had increased the BI limits. There was no law saying whether 1, 2, or 3 or all of them would trigger the right to offer or the obligation to offer the stack. There was a federal court case which said, no, they don't, but no state court decisions. At the time, AIG had a case working its way up through the courts to address that assessment, but it had not yet been decided. So AIG was operating in the dark as to what it would do. So those witnesses are coverage witnesses. as far as the timeliness of payment, those would be regular adjusters. And again, according to the terms of the policy, the parties have a right to demand arbitration. Arbitration was demanded, and until that arbitration was completed, there was no obligation to pay. So we're talking about two different sets of witnesses.
Mr. Goto, we've gone about 31 minutes. Anything that you'd like to wrap up for the court here before we move back to Mr. Park for his rebuttal?
Thank you. Nothing further.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Goto. Mr. Park, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. As it's been stated previously, we are being remanded back by the ICA for a new trial or a trial on bad faith. And we are requesting that these the court be overturned on the rulings on the motion to preclude and motion to amend so that we will be able to try a full case, complete case, and not, you know, the full scope of the bad faith. And it's been the policy of the court to allow bad faith cases to be tried. And there were a lot of points that Mr. Goto made. I'll just try to point out a few here. He was talking about the policy of stacking, and there was case law floating and so forth. Like, well, Allstate Kaneshiro had been decided many years before, but when you look at their claim file, they had a policy called Max Stack. That's an internal policy. And under that, that's what we went by, because there's no doubt. And in fact, there's entries in the diary where the justice said, this comes under Max Stack. We should concede the 1.2. But then the senior adjuster tells these people, when they ask what should be done, tell Park it's still 3570. Okay, because if they had told us 1.2, we wouldn't have needed to file the suit. And then we would have turned around and made a demand for the 1.2. But we couldn't until they finally conceded. And then it's when we made a policy limit demand. You know, counsel also talks about this Crescentia case. And as we pointed out, there was a requirement of particularity in that case. But that case involved fraud, which is an exception to the general notice pleading rule. So again, defense counsel is trying to limit us to specifics in our complaint, but under notice pleading, we pled sufficient theory here or allegation of bad faith. And again, it covers a lot of different grounds. So we couldn't probably even, until we do finish discovery, for example, we tried to get the rest of the claim file that for the period following filing of suit before the arbitration and were denied. I'm sure there's gonna be more bad faith conduct included in that file. I would bet on it. Okay.
Justice Nakayama has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Park, is the gravamen of your amended complaint the failure to settle or pay, as Mr. Goto has kind of implied?
I think it's part of our bad faith claim. It's not the only claim we're making. And I don't think...
Well, what about what Mr. Goto says in your initial complaint? You never alleged a cause of action for failure to settle or delay payment.
At that time, we did not know what the policy limit, they had not acknowledged policy limit. So we could not make a demand for policy limits without.
Okay, if you didn't know what the policy limits were and you didn't make a claim for failure to settle or delay in payment, then why isn't that a new cause of action that would stand alone on a breach of contract or a bad faith that expired 6 years after the payment of the ARB award?
Our position Justice, is that those would be our facts. For example, as we stated in our motion to amend, that is not a new claim. The claim is bad faith, which is broad. Okay, and it should not be limited if we go back to trial in terms of trying to prove bad faith.
Very well. Mr. Park, I think we've gone about the 4 minutes we had, but you know, I'd like to give you a chance to wrap up if you have any final thoughts for the court.
Well, yeah. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you. Let me read my closing statement. The ICA's rulings will cause chaos and confusion in the future if allowed to stand. Therefore, it is imperative that this court vacate these rulings to allow the plaintiff to try the full scope of a bad faith case unimpeded.
Very well. Anything further for the court at this time? All right, hearing nothing from our counsel, the court will take this matter under advisement. Thanks to both of you for your arguments here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha, ho'o kolo kolo ki'e ki'e hano hano o ka moko aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.